go.
Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Thank you, Randy. Loud and clear on my Mac on iTunes, Randy tells us. That's wonderful to hear. Thank you very, very kindly. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where you'll find the Listen Live button, although you can also, in this more modern era of mobile devices, you can also pick up the stream at TuneIn Radio or Stitcher Internet Radio, both of whom have wonderful apps for your tablet, mobile, smart eye device. And which we recommend highly. They also have record functions, those apps do, so you can just set your app to record the program and listen to it at your leisure. Or, of course, you can always sign up for the podcast over at whiterosesociety.org under the subdomain for this program, and the program will be delivered to you easily and effortlessly. Yeah, Randy, as a matter of fact, we are still listed on Roku devices, to the best of my knowledge. You can find us at streamer.com, dart.fm, goodness me, Bono. Yeah, all kinds of possibilities there. And, of course, there's access to the chat room at headonradionetwork.com. I always encourage people to come on by and participate in the chat room just because it's so doggone fun. Hello, Nascent. Sparky's in the room. Texas Betsy's in the room. I'm there. So welcome to you all. And, of course, yes, the website, headonradionetwork.com, is also where you go if you want to help us keep this whole thing running. Which is deeply appreciated when you do. Big thanks going out right at the top of the program this evening. Big thanks going out to Margaret, because she got us started on tonight's fundraising in a big way. You know, we look for 10 people, 10 bucks a piece, 15 people, 10 bucks a piece, that sort of thing, to get us through any given evening, and we are still in a fundraising hole. But Margaret threw several spades of earth into that hole earlier this evening, or earlier today, I should say, about 9 hours ago, and took care of 10 of those spaces, so we are only $50 away from being done with this evening's fundraising, and anything that comes in on top of that goes toward, spading in more earth on top of into the hole that we are seemingly perpetually in. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Margaret. And thanks also from last night to Paul. And thanks very much to Grant, all of whom have gone toward helping things. Paul last night. And Grant is, by the way, I'm sure he would like for you to know, Grant's a subscriber. He went over to the website and just chose the monthly subscription option. And so, without even thinking about it, bang, there it is, every month, without, you know, having to run and remember to do that sort of thing. So if you want to try the subscription option, you are more than welcome to do that. Now, this is Yeah, what do we call this here? Yeah, we call this Titanic Tuesday. Titanic Tuesday on the horn. So named for the Titanic intellect present in the actions, the behavior, the day-to-day living of members of the right wing. And Lord God, we have... We are rich. We are rich in Titanic intellect. Titanic Tuesday being named, of course, for that event, that one day when a 972nd-tier right-wing talker over in Beckley, West Virginia, advised one of his mouth-breathing, knuckle-walking, snake-handling followers that, yes, there are fossilized shellfish in the rock strata of West Virginia far, far from the ocean because of the movement of the Titanic plates. Yes. Mm-hmm. No word on the Titanic goblets or tureens or, yeah, you get the idea. And also no mention of the fact that this entire area where the Appalachians are was once a big swamp that might have had sea creatures in it, trilobites even, funny little millions of years old gastropods and whatnot. No, that's beyond the reach of your average right winger. Atne ute aitbre that they are, if you one what I mean. Yeah, we don't want to confuse them. So, I wanted to back up to something that I had thought it would be wise to take care of last night, just because I hate to let something like this pass. And I'm talking, of course, about Randy Paul, Goatwig Boy. If you were listening to Dr. Bill just a few minutes ago, and if you weren't, why not? You're not gonna get any better. And whatever you think you know about the origins of the United States will be completely challenged by Dr. Bill on any given Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday afternoon. But Dr. Bill addressed the story of cranky old Ron Paul going to the capital of the Confederacy, Richmond, Virginia, and praising one of those legal concepts that plagued the early United States and which ultimately led to some 600,000 people getting killed in that little dust-up between 1861 and 1865 that we commonly refer to as the Civil War. So, Ron Paul thinks nullification is a Jim Dandy thing, and one of these days we're all just going to live in a nullified world where, in his words, the states live as they see fit, and the federal and they just ignore the federal government. Because who needs a federal government? Who needs roads? Who needs bridges? Who needs, well, Texas, where Ron Paul's from, needs roads and bridges and federal money that pays for, yeah, you get it. Ron Paul, who I will remind you, once said in a biographical article of him about him, I think in the New York Times, you can look it up. The interweb tubes are magic that way. Held out as a hero, a black market butcher who illegally sold meat during the Second World War, contrary to the rationing rules that were in place in this country. The rationing rules being in place, of course, so that our soldiers overseas fighting global fascism could, you know, eat. Because regardless of whatever it is that cranky old Ron Paul says armies still march on their stomachs, and the logistics of maintaining some several hundred thousand, if not a million, people under arms in foreign lands, the logistics of just keeping them fed is mind-boggling. But old free marketeer nullifying, you know, and that's what that was. That story out of his boyhood days in Pittsburgh. That was a story of nullification. The butcher said, screw our soldiers. Screw patriotism. Screw this country. I want to make a profit on my meat. And therefore sold it illegally, and Ron Paul thinks that was heroism. And he, of course, raised Rand Paul. Randy Paul, Goatwig Boy. Yeah. And every time I see Randy Paul, Goatwig Boy, I think of this ad from back in the 90s. This is for you, Rand Paul. Maybe. Such a slow computer.
Presents Real Men of Genius.
Real Men of Genius.
Today we salute you, Mr. Really Bad Toupee Wearer.
Mr. Really Bad Toupee Wearer.
More than any neon sign or exploding scoreboard ever could, your chrome dome cover says, "Hey guys, look at me."
What could you be thinking?
You think it looks natural, but it couldn't look phonier if it had a chin strap.
I'd look at you.
Made of space-age fibers, it can repel anything. Rain, wind, snow, and especially young women.
I don't think so.
So crack open an ice-cold Budweiser, Mr. Stud in a Rug. Then crack open another for that thing on your head.
I don't think it's all straight.
That's my favorite part, the choir in the background. I don't think so. I don't think it's on straight. So anyway, Randy Paul, Goatwig Boy, of course you know, was caught up in a plagiarism scandal, which he refuses to acknowledge as a scandal. And just, I'm looking at a photo of him here, and you know what? The choir is right. I don't think it's on straight. It couldn't look less natural if it had a chin strap. App. My God. He got real teddy when Rachel Maddow, rhymes with shadow, when Rachel Maddow called him out for being a rank plagiarist who couldn't get through ninth grade English. I said that. She didn't. And it turned out that he has plagiarized so many times that it's almost impossible to keep track. The man not open his mouth in a speech without stealing somebody else's language. Sure gives you second thoughts about, I wonder how many visually disabled people there are who were perfectly healthy when they went to Randy Paul, Goatwig Boy, libertarian ophthalmologist. I'm rich, I'm comfortably well off, I'm socially secure. I may be a coward, but I'm a greedy coward. He's also Daffy Duck. No, he got a mite miffed when he got called on the plagiarism. Tried to say it wasn't so. Tried to say that he'd credited his sources, but it didn't hold water. And so finally, in a moment of rare candor, Randy Paul, Goatwig Boy, wandered over to, wandered over to This Week with George Snuffleupagus. Now you see him, now you don't. That's why he's a Snuffleupagus. Only Big Bird can see him. Wandered over to explain his position on, well, his plagiarism. Because it was plagiarism, you know. Not only does he not know what it is, I'll bet the little bastard can't spell it.
I questions this week about your speeches and whether or not you were committing plagiarism after reports that language in some of your speeches was lifted directly from Wikipedia, including from our colleague Jorge Ramos of Fusion. Here's what that exchange.
They accuse you of stealing four lines from Wikipedia for your speech at Liberty University. So is this true?
We borrowed the plot lines from Gattaca. It's a movie, and I gave credit to the people who wrote the movie. There are technicalities to this, but nothing I said was not given attribution to where it came from.
Except for the fact that you did not give attribution to Wikipedia, but you guys know all that background stuff, right? And by the way, he stole language for a speech at Liberty University. That, of course, is Jerry Falwell University to us. So he went and lied to the evangelical fundamentalist religion industry people going to that school where you learn that Adam and Eve rode to school on the back of a dinosaur. You can't make this stuff up.
And on the third day, God created the Remington bolt-action rifle so that man could fight the dinosaurs and the homosexuals.
Amen.
That's your that's an excerpt from the 400 level senior biology class at Jerry Falwell University. So that's all past his prologue, right. We got that. And he hems and haws and makes excuses for why he did what he did. Never takes any of that personal responsibility that pig lickings are always hollering that the rest of us have to take. But like castor oil, we couldn't catch them dead taking it themselves. As a West Virginia professional broadcaster says, theirselves.
I know you dismiss that as making a mountain out of a mole, but since then, Politico reported that there were...
God damn it, George Snuffleupagus. It's not making a mountain out of a mole. You can't make a mountain out of a mole. That's like making a pyramid out of a lemming. Clichés are clichés for a reason. It's a mole hill, George. I'm sorry, I don't mean to get off track or anything, but... Are there no knowers of words left in America? I mean, I have this vision of English teachers just howling, screaming, mountain out of a mole. And he really did say that. I know you think this is making a mountain out of a mole.
I dismiss that as making a mountain out of a mole, but since then, Politico reported that...
Does he mean the little creature, the mole, or is he thinking about that thing with the hairs springing out of it that's growing on his back? Making a mountain out of a mole. Where do these... Who... And this guy's pulling down millions of dollars to tell America about Rand Paul thinking people are making mountains out of moles. When in fact, Rand Paul represents a state where they make moonscapes out of mountains. Oh, God, help me.
There were more instances where you used words that first appeared in other places. And I know you dismissed those questions, but do you concede at least that this is pretty sloppy? And don't you have to tighten up your speech-making operation if you indeed do want to have a presidential run?
Well, you know, the footnote police have really been dogging me for the last week. I will admit that. And I will admit sometimes we haven't footnoted things properly. In fact, I've given thousands of speeches, and I don't think I've ever footnoted any of those speeches. In the speech in question, I...
Wait, there's a footnote police? That's what this is about, footnoting? It's not about essential lack of integrity? It's not about academic or intellectual theft, which it is? No, it's just footnoting. And, well, you know, mistakes were made. And isn't that what Rob Ford said today in Toronto? Could there be a connection here? Wait a minute. While he was talking, I think that thing on his head sort of wiggled. Is it like, you know, blinking SOS? Is it trying to tell us that he's lying? Because there's this new thing I learned about from our buddy Horst just yesterday, and I'm scared to death that my daughters are going to learn about it. They're called Neko Mimis. And no, really, for approximately $137, you can buy, and this is kind of, it's very junior high school girl oriented. It's a headband with little foam, fuzzy, cute cat ears. Snow leopards, leopards, kitty cats, white cats, black cats. Cat ears. And it's got a little brainwave sensor that rides on the on the forehead, you know, underneath the bangs. And it's got another sensor that clips to the earlobe, and it reads brainwave emissions, and then broadcasts them to the world by making the kitty cat ears turn in particular directions, so that just with one glance at the kitty cat ears, you can know what your teenage BFF is really thinking in terms of mood or attitude. Hell, we just went with mood rings when I was a kid. It was always fun to put the mood ring on the pet rock. Just turn black. Yes, pet rocks are never in a good mood. You would be too if you were an incarcerated rock. So, I don't know, look for those to be sort of hacked and adapted for electroencephalograms for the uninsured or something. But I'm sorry, I digressed. It happens.
Well, you know, the footnote police have really been dogging me for the last week. I will admit that. And I will admit sometimes we haven't footnoted things properly. In fact, I've given thousands of speeches, and I don't think I've ever footnoted any of those speeches. In the speech in question, I quoted from 1984, Gattaca, My Left Foot, Michelangelo, Einstein, and Ray Bradbury, among maybe a dozen others. And I attributed everything to them.
I was wondering.
But I didn't get into the secondary sources and say, I quoted Einstein as according to an AP story or as according to Wikipedia. So I think the spoken word shouldn't be held to the same sort of standard that you have if you're giving a scientific paper.
Right. In the spoken word, you shouldn't say as, I don't know, let's see, as Mark Twain once said, it is better to be silent and thought a fool than to open one's mouth and prove it. Or maybe that was Oscar Wilde. No. Or it, you know, in the spoken word, we shouldn't hold it to the same standards. We shouldn't say, as Mark Twain said, assume you were an idiot. Now assume you're a member of Congress. But I repeat myself. No, we'll just say that and hope that people get the reference. Oh, he's clever. Did you hear him? Well, yeah, I saw what he did there. I heard what he did there. He worked in some Twain there. And because, you know, he's so clever, he's waiting to see how many of us catch it.
Written scientific papers. I know how to footnote things, but we've never foot...
Really? And you learned all that footnoting at Baylor, didn't you? You expect us to believe that, Randy Paul Gutwig boy? Because we know you were down in Hog Creek worshipping Aqua Buddha at the time. You know, pot hurts, man. It makes you forget things. Dude, this is your brain on drugs. You gonna eat that?
Noted speeches. And if that's the standard I'm gonna be held to, yes, we will change and we will footnote things. Everything in that paper, if I had presented it for an academic, or that speech for an academic publication, we'd have had footnotes next to it. In some of the other things that are now going to pop up under thousands of things I've written, yeah, there are times when they've been sloppy or not correct or we've made an error. But the difference is I take it as an insult, and I will not lie down and say people can call me dishonest, misleading, or misrepresenting. I have never intentionally done so.
Well, intentionally. As long as you've got an adverb in front of your dishonesty, misleading, lying, scurrilous behavior, well, okay. You just ignorantly did it. You hear that? The junior senator from the Commonwealth of Kentucky stand just pled not guilty by reason of stupid. And then there's this. See, it's so cool to have a Horn family commune who are, you know, smart. Sandra just pointed out citations are not footnotes. And that's true. There's rather a difference. And that's without even getting into the whole the stylistic choice between footnotes and endnotes. And regarding making a mountain out of a mole, Michael from Sebastopol notes, "Hello, Bob. My thanks. Glad that annoys you, too. I thought I was nitpicking. If I hear hard row to go or hard row to hoe, I'm going to scream." Paren again. Close paren. Bob adds paren. Some more. Close paren. No, you're not alone. English is not entirely dead yet, but it, you know, it's coughing up blood on the porch. Texas Betsy noting, "My middle school students are learning to give proper citations. Right now they're still getting the hang of it, but they're on their way at 12 and 13 and 14. And Texas Betsy, "I'll warrant you that Randy Paul Goatwig Boy and libertarian ophthalmologist couldn't even get a mercy D in your class." So no, Michael, you're not alone. A note with nothing but a subject line coming from Jim. "The Ibid op sit passim and idem kid." Irish Dave asking, "Is plagiarizing the wiki just a bad choice?" Yeah. And then from Dr. John, who is in a position to actually take things like plagiarism rather seriously, as does Dr. Bill, "I'd imagine Baylor is none too pleased to hear alumnus Rand Paul defend his plagiarism. Like with the law, ignorance is no defense." Yeah, you would think it's kind of obvious, wouldn't you? Sandra asking, APA, MLA, Chicago, would Paul know about these? My guess is, Sandra, he got past Baylor's freshman comp 101 and 102, turned his, well, he probably had a full head of hair back then, turned his flowing mane to the back toward the English department of Baylor University, and moved on. From Jim, "You are a sketch, stud with a rug." Hey, and thanks very much to Rob, who is helping out Margaret from earlier with a $10 contribution. Thank you very much, Rob. Thank you. We're on our way. We may see if we. I think we can see maybe getting a little further out of the hole this evening. It'd be wonderful. So, back to Randy Paul Goatwig Boy, because we haven't gotten to the good part.
And like I say, if dueling were legal in Kentucky, if they keep it up, you know, it'd be a dual challenge. But I can't do that because I can't hold office in Kentucky.
So what's the fix?
And that was the good part. Just want to let that sink all the way in.
If you're giving a scientific paper, I've written scientific papers. I know how to footnote things, but we've never footnoted speeches. And if that's the standard I'm going to be held to, yes, we will change and we will footnote things. Everything in that paper, if I had presented it for an act.
Yeah, what kind of scientific papers has he written? Libertarian Approaches to Profitizing the Eyeball? Ayn Rand and the Eyeball? A case for enlightened selfishness? You know, you get the idea that when he was growing up, the little game you play with children, I've got your nose. I bet these libertarian freaks in the Paul household played that for keeps.
Academic or that speech for an academic publication, we'd have footnotes next to it. In some of the other things that are now going to pop up under thousands of things I've written, yeah, they're
are now going to pop up. In other words, there's but wait, there's more. I've been stealing language since God was a baby. I've been stealing language since I had hair. I don't think it's on straight.
Times when they've been sloppy or not correct, or we've made an error. But the difference is, I take it as an insult, and I will not lie down and say people can call me dishonest, misleading, or misrepresenting. I have never intentionally done so. And like I say, if dueling were legal in Kentucky, if they keep it up, you know, it'd be a dual challenge. But I can't do that because I can't hold office in Kentucky.
So what's the fix?
So never, So just blow right past that, George Snuffleupagus. Pretend he didn't say it, because after all, you're a member of the for-profit media, and you wouldn't want to make life difficult for Randy Paul, goat wig boy. No, I mean, you want access, right, George? You gotta have the access. It's an addictive substance to you. Access to you is what rock cocaine is to Rob Ford. Yeah. Don't challenge him on the fact that he just said he wanted to murder Rachel Maddow in cold blood. Blow right past that, George Snuffleupagus, you for-profit media freaking loser, you. Blow right past it, because that's what he said. And then, did you notice the excuse he gave for why he couldn't call Ms. Maddow out onto the field of honor? Because if I did, I couldn't be senator anymore. Daddy, does this mean I'm not going to be senator anymore since I done run Ms. Maddow through for besmirching my honor? Afraid so, son. We'll see if we can't set you up shop selling black market beef like my hero during the Second World War. So, if I could, I would call her out on for a duel, except that's illegal. No, not that. If I could, I would call her out for a duel, but I don't hold to committing murder. Mm-mm. Note to the Kentucky Stand Democratic Party. Run with this. Next time it comes around for, him to be reelected. Run. A sitting member of the Senate of the United States of America just time-traveled to 1856, and he thinks that he's Preston Brooks and that Rachel Maddow is Charles Sumner. He just time-traveled to 1804, and he thinks he's Aaron Burr, and Rachel Maddow is Alexander Hamilton. These people are so pre-Civil War that I'm surprised they know it was ever even fought. Daddy's out there praising secession and nullification. And his dumb shit son is calling Rachel Maddow out to a duel and admitting on live effing television in front of whomever watches this that he has a taste for murder. But, and this is kind of the important part that I haven't seen raised anywhere else in the coverage of this. This is par for the course. Go back in time. What was it, 2010? And the great Rand Paul supporter curb-stomping controversy when one of his vociferous supporters tried to stomp a person into oblivion for simply criticizing Rand Paul. It happened. And even then, Rand Paul had, Gutwit boy, had the devil's own time trying to figure out a way to not completely disavow that. I wonder if henceforward Rand Paul is going to carry a pair of white gloves in his jacket pocket just in case he gets near enough to Rachel Maddow to slap her with one. I will see you on the field of honor at dawn. Of course, that would mean that Rachel Maddow got choice of weapons, and, well, can't you just see her choosing, say, the GRE or the SAT? Yep, standardized testing at 20 paces. Do I still get 500 points for getting my name right? Yeah, but you gotta leave the wig at home. It's not a wig! But you know how he said in that interview with George Snuffleupagus that there will be more? Well, it turns out he got busy after that. Because on the heels of Andrew Kaczynski over at BuzzFeed figuring out that Randy Paul Goatwig Boy had copied 1,318 words from a 2003 Heritage Foundation case study without citing or attributing, or as he says, attributing. Well, it turns out that a hasty bit of, shall we call it, historic revisionism has been taking place over at the Rand Paul Senate website. Because a bunch of the plagiarized speeches have now miraculously disappeared. Praise Aqua Buddha! There are at least four speeches that have been disappeared down the memory hole. Dueling were legal in Kentucky. If they keep it up, you know it would be a duel challenge. But I can't do that because I can't hold office in Kentucky then. I'm being unfairly targeted by a bunch of hacks and haters, and I'm just not going to put up with people casting aspersions on my character. Call Louis Gohmert. Let him tell you about the asparagus. Tell me about the asparagus. George, when am I going to get some asparagus? So I just kind of had to get that out of the way. Because it was driving me nuts. If we had a responsible Senate, wouldn't a responsible Senate chastise or admonish or censure him for wanting to publicly stating that he wants to murder somebody? Wouldn't it be neat if we had a member of the United States Senate who was willing to at least propose such a Senate resolution? Well, but maybe not, because then Randy Paul Goatwick Boy and the thing on his head would come over and probably challenge the person offering the resolution to another duel. Glue solvent at 10 paces. No, not that. Anything but that. See, Jim's thinking along the same lines I am. He notes, no, Bob, the weapons should be a leaf blower. Whose hair stays on wins? Fair enough. I retract my scurrilous statement and admit that Ms. Maddow was entirely correct. Are you satisfied, Ms. Maddow?
Yes, I am.
So, you know, we're just started. We're just getting started with Titanic Tuesday. Let's take a little break. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Once that you've decided on a killing, first you make a stone of your heart. And if you find that your hands are still willing, then you can turn a murder into art. There really isn't any more bloodshed. Just do it with a little more finesse. If you can slip a tablet into someone's coffee, then it avoids an awful lot.
Long-distance dedication going out to Randy Paul, Goatwig Boy. The Police and Murder by Numbers. Actually, this would be... Never mind. I don't like to keep people sitting in line. Lines are open, 304-658-3333 on Skype. Bob Kincaid Horn, jump right in. Either way is fine by me. We'll continue on with our Titanic Tuesday stories, but we'll digress to the telephones right quick. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening.
Hey, Jim.
How are you tonight, sir?
I don't know. Full of myself, I guess. And anytime you get to deconstruct Randy Paul, Goatwig Boy, well, you're having a good night.
Well, you know, I've wondered about the guy's hair. I mean, I don't have any problems in wearing a rig on his head, but Lord have mercy, that thing looks like he just jumped out of bed and put it in the dryer and then went to an Vandegraaff generator for styling. I mean, he could be...
Well said. Well said.
He could be a spokesman for GE.
Oh.
I thought John Micah had really gotten the prize for, you know, for...
What was his name? Trafficant, too. I mean, he had a first-rate rug, didn't he? Remember him?
Yeah, but, you know, they make those planes so well now that you can barely detect what they are. I mean, look at Elton John. I mean, you can tell that that's not all his hair. And
I thought he got plugs.
No, he couldn't. He didn't have enough plugs to move up front. I mean, I'm sorry. He'd have to, it looks good and stuff like that. A man in his position, Mr. Micah, Mr. Rand Paul, at least should be able to get a little advice from some female member of his staff or some male member of his
staff. Perhaps that choir singing, I don't think it's on straight.
Well, whatever, but I mean, you know, it's not just the fact that what can I say?
When you get a moment, and everybody else too, our buddy brother Albert pointed out something to me in the last couple of days with regard to Rand Paul's wig. You remember Kids in the Hall, Jim?
Oh yeah, sure.
Okay, so
Lauren Michaels crowd.
The Canadian, yeah. So there's a skit they did one time called it's Mr. Man, MANN.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called My Horrible Secret.
Mm-hmm.
It's worth going and looking up.
I saw that back in 1994 or something like that, I believe, or something like that.
Well, I went and saw it again, and in conjunction with the consideration of
I mean, those guys did some incredible skits and things like that. They were very good with comedy.
Oh, yes, they were.
I mean, you know, I used to love Benny Hill, too, and some of the crazy stuff he did. He was just absolutely nuts. I can remember the time when he had on some guy dressed up like Mr. T in a pink outfit. That was the craziest thing I've ever seen in my life. But, you know, it's just amazing. But at least the senator should, number one, get a copy of Kate Turabian's Chicago Manual of Style, and number two, go to a different barber or hairdresser or place called the Second Herring or whatever you want to call it. Y'all really ought to. But that one kind of fooled me because I thought to myself, is this guy just getting out of bed and not even bother to brush his hair?
If it was more of a henned color, Jim, would it be a red herring?
Oh, I guess so. I mean, you know,
I'm trying here.
Bob, there are two things that are bad and I think are the worst looking things in the world. One is a cheap toupee, one of those Taylor toppers you find in the back of a magazine, and a dirty aquarium.
Well, I never thought of it in that. But yes, those are both nasty.
They are indeed. And I'm not going to keep you long here. I'd just like to send out a piece of memorabilia. Today is November 5th, and that is the birth date of Vivien Leigh, Dame Olivier.
Oh, I had no idea.
Who was always, in my opinion, one of the most beautiful women who ever appeared on the screen, as well as an actress. And God, did she suffer from so many things, and yet was able to accomplish.
Yeah, she had terrible mental illness, didn't she?
Yeah, she was bipolar, and actually was supposed to appear in Elephant Walk. Well, Vivien Leigh was born in India, and her parents were British colonists there, and then she came back to Great Britain or the United Kingdom. And, you know, found her way on the stage and stuff like that and played so many wonderful roles. Only lived to be 54 because, in addition to having the mental problems, she also died of of tuberculosis at Twickenham in 1967. And she has always held a special place in my heart. Particularly, I mean, not just for playing Miss Scarlet and Gone with the Wind, and I don't want to get into that, but for the job she did in Streetcar, That Hamilton Woman, and also on Ship of Fools as Mrs. Treadwell. I tell you, God, I have seen Lee Marvin play some tough roles, but if you've seen A Ship of Fools when he went into her room by mistake thinking she was a lady of the evening.
I have not seen that.
Oh, God.
I've never seen a bad Lee Marvin movie.
Well, Lee Marvin got drunk and he had paid some Spanish lady on the ship for services rendered, and he went into Vivian Lee's stateroom by mistake, and she literally beat the living daylight. She beat the shit out of him. I mean, he's a tough guy, really is. And she set him all over the companionway of that ship after she got him out of her stateroom. But she was an incredibly beautiful woman who was beset by a lot of tragedy, but yet she accomplished so much in spite of the things that tried to weigh her down through her life. And I've always loved her.
I wonder how much of the portrayal she gave in the film version of A Streetcar Named Desire was based on her ability to tap into internal...
That is a very good point. Blanche DuBois, poor thing, she had fallen on hard times and had to come stay with Stanley Kowalski and her sister, and I can remember different excerpts from lines like A Lemon Coke and, oh, looking into the mirror, she said, and daylight has never seen such a ruin with that blonde wig on, but she certainly played that role quite well. And she's deserving of our remembrance tonight because she contributed so much to the visual art of the cinema. And she certainly made an impression upon me. Even Miss Scarlet in Gone with the Wind. Who else could have played Scarlet Vivian Leigh? There is nobody else who could have done it.
Was anyone else even considered?
Oh, God, they had a whole thing. Joan Crawford, Betty Davis.
Well, okay, yeah, I know, but it take either one of those. Really? As Scarlet, please.
They couldn't have done it.
Joan Crawford as Scarlet?
No. She was too damn mean.
And Betty Davis was too, what?
Well,
aloof?
Aloof, and, you know, basically, I'm not exactly sure if she could have done it. I mean, it would have taken one hell of a dialogue coach for Betty Davis to have done
that. That was what I was thinking.
But you know, when they, you know, she was discovered very, you know, they had already burned Atlanta and done everything when they were making that film. I've got a whole commemorative set of Gone with the Wind, and it's got all the David O. Selznick memos.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a memo freak. I mean, talk about somebody who was OCD about everything. I mean, he even stopped the whole shooting because one of the Tarleton twins, played by George Reeves, who later became Superman, he said, no, you've got to stop this, re-dye his hair, it's too red. It looks like it's got henna in it. And he, you know, to read the memos that guy wrote, I mean, he was Mr. Memo, but he...
And you can verify if you know. Marty just dropped a note in and said, before Vivian Leigh, I do believe Lucille Ball was considered for...
Yeah, they had a whole... they used to have contests as far as things like that are concerned. I mean, they even had a big contest about what to call Joan Crawford because she was originally, her name, she was from Texas. Her real name was Lucille LeSueur. And she came from very humble beginnings and, you know, got started in the, I guess, the films of the 20s and stuff like that is, you know, films like Our Dancing Daughters and things of that nature. She was a little bit too wild and less subdued than Scarlett should be or been, but that's another story.
And beyond the simple elements of Scarlett, Jim, you have to think for a minute. Take a moment and pair Joan Crawford up against Clark Gable.
I don't think that would have worked.
Betty Davis?
I don't think that would have worked either.
Lucille Ball, sorry?
No. Vivian Leigh did not like kissing Clark Gable because he wore dentures. And, of course, he was, you know, she was very much in love with Sir Laurence Olivier, or Laurence Olivier at the time.
Yeah, Larry to his friends.
Larry to his friends, Sir Larry, and just wanted to get back to England to be with him. And she could not wait for that film to be over. I mean, it was a very grueling thing. But nonetheless, it's just incredible to see what people will do for art and how well they have performed. And to have done what she did under the direction of David O. Selznick, I mean, they had so many directors for that film. There was, I mean, I can't name them all at the present time, but I think Korda and there was another director who was too harsh on the women, but who loved Clark Gable. But they had to really go through a whole host of Victor Fleming. They had to go through a lot of directors who could work well with the women, like Olivia de Havilland and Vivian Leigh and the other members of the cast. But if I know the movie is a lot offensive to a lot of people for what it portrays, but nonetheless, you gotta admit one thing that Scarlett said. She didn't want to hear anything about any damn war. And Clark Gable, as Rhett Butler, just said, gentlemen, this is going to make a hell of a lot of difference to a lot of gentlemen, because you don't have a single fucking a single cannon factory in the South, and all you have is slaves, cotton.
Didn't he call them fools at one point?
He was there at 12 Oaks, and, you know, of course, Leslie Howard stepped in, and he had to get the men from Charles Hamilton from calling him out to a duel. And he just said, all you people have is ignorant slaves and cotton. And basically, both those people really predicted the end of that little conflagration and what it would end up as. And, you know, not necessarily for the period that it portrays and all the stuff that are offensive to a lot of listeners in the Horn family and a lot of listeners' people. It was a damn good movie, and it did show what happened when the South was overrun and when they had to...
Well, I mean, it's at least not Birth of a Nation showing the Klan as some sort of heroic force.
No, not at all. And there was another lady who I've always honored for her role in that film, and that would be Hattie McDaniel. My Lord, she was incredible. She was just an incredible woman, and she played so many, you know, domestics, but still could rise above the level of being a domestic servant.
Oh, she was an actor.
She was a wonderful actress. Wonderful actress. And I just wanted to let you know, like, November 5th, 1913 was the day that Miss Vivian Leigh was born, and she died, I think, in June 5th or thereabouts in 1967 of TB.
Well, you know, you mentioned it, all of this reminds me of something from my dim and distant past. I was lucky enough to go to public school when there was enough money to do things for students, and so periodically we would go on field trips to go and see traveling theater companies in Huntsville, Alabama, at the von Braun Civic Center.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to I think it may have been Showboat.
Was that in Huntsville?
Uh-huh.
Huntsville's not a typical Alabama city.
No, anything but.
Presence there. I mean, it's a federal city.
But I was talking to a friend of mine who still lives there, and he said it is absolutely up to its neck in teabaggery now, which is sad.
That is.
But I'm trying to think. It seems like it was Showboat, perhaps, or maybe it was Porgy and Bess. But I got to see, on stage, live in Huntsville, Alabama, in a touring company, Miss Butterfly McQueen.
Oh, Lord, yes. Yeah.
And obviously, you know, here we are 32 years later, and I still remember it.
You know, it's a funny thing. Years ago, back in the 80s, they had a some type of celebration at the State Library, and I got an invitation because I was an education officer, and I went. And I met Alicia Rhett, who actually starred in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And she was also a big radio personality in Charleston, South Carolina. And I have an autograph of, they had a little monograph there, and I have an autograph there.
And of course, Atlanta still plays homage to the film in ever so many ways. Back when I lived there, you could go for breakfast or lunch or maybe even dinner to a little restaurant called Aunt Pity Pat's Porch.
Well, you know, back in 1939, my mother was a young woman, and she and her mother, number one, when Gone with the Wind came out, went over to a book company Bryan's or something like that. I can't remember the name of the place. And they actually bought two copies, autographed by Margaret Mitchell, of Gone with the Wind because she was there signing books in Columbia.
Wow. Still got them?
I have one. My sister has the other. And
I would imagine that has some value.
It does, I think. I don't know what it costs. I would never think of parting with it. It will go to my nephew or for my demise, but nonetheless. But they motored over. That's what my grandmother would always say. They motored over.
Yes, they
my
motored.
Grandmother never drove, but she didn't like to drive. But then they were able to go to the grand opening at Lowe's Theater in Atlanta.
Oh, my.
And
yeah, that was a palace.
Oh, yeah.
It was one of the grand movie palaces of the
South. Oh, absolutely.
And in Atlanta alongside the Fabulous Fox.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it put the audience to shame, but nonetheless, they had the whole thing of the, as my mom tells me, it was the front of the theater was reconstructed to look like the, I guess, the pillars at 12 Oaks, which never really existed. It was all mat shots and stuff like that. That was all mat shots. And,
yeah.
Whereas Tower really did, I think. But,
well, one of the mansions, in, I think, the West Paces Ferry area of Atlanta, served for a bunch of interiors.
It probably did. They did a lot of the Hollywood shots. No, God only knows the salesman. What he would do and the lengths that he would go to make things realistic. For example, the burning of Atlanta, what they did, they took all the old movie props from the movies like Intolerance and stuff like that were still standing and set them ablaze. And they had to call every fire department within the confines of the LA area to.
Yeah, stand. Cecil B. DeMille had nothing on David Selznick.
No, sir. And it was that night when they were burning Atlanta, that's when Myron Selznick, David's brother, he said, I have scarlet. And who would have thought that an English girl born in India made her way about the stage, and while she was in, I'm not sure exactly how they brought her in or whatever, but he recognized her talent to play that part. They did a damn good day's work. Particularly, there were so many people who were vying for that part. And they used to have these regular contests, like I said before, about like what they call Joan Crawford, you know. They used to have, and then they had Marcel Waves and stuff like that as something you could get when you went to the theater if you drew the right ticket. My mom told me a lot of stuff. I wish I had gotten a tape recorder. And because I tell you, that lady certainly knew how to talk, and I can tell you my mother is one who never suffered a fool gladly, and who always, his motto was, if you want to hear something bad, come and sit by me.
And by the way, it's not just her birthday today. This would be her 100th birthday.
100th birthday, absolutely. And there's a book on Amazon called Vivian. There had been several biographies of her. One's called Vivian. And this is the new book that just came out on Amazon that tells about her personal story and this, that, and the other. And unfortunately, her marriage to Sir Laurence Olivier was not exactly because of her mental illness and stuff like that. And like I said before, they had to withdraw.
And because of Laurence Olivier's own life.
Exactly. And, of course, he ended up marrying Joan Plowright. But what they did with Elephant Walk was they had to bring in Elizabeth Taylor, and that's how she first got started as a big star on the screen.
Oh, and by the way, one more, and I'm sure you already know this, and we just didn't mention it, but I know she's a favorite of yours. One more of the people who were considered as a potential scarlet, and you can buy this. Certainly, you can buy into this more easily than Katharine Hepburn or Lucille Ball or Joan Crawford, Tallulah Bankhead.
Oh, my Lord, yes. Now, you've opened up a whole book about Tallulah.
Daughter of an Alabama senator.
I love that woman. Daughter of Will Bankhead.
For whom a national forest is named, in which I have hiked.
Listen, Tallulah was a mess. She really was. I mean, she was just so outrageous. I mean, when they put her in Lifeboat, directed by Hitchcock,
mm-hmm.
well, she took the movie because it was kind of hard and she needed the money. She had bought this place out of New England called Windows. But the way they staged all the fog and stuff for that movie was they used oil, I mean, like petroleum oil, to generate part of the smog. And hell, off the cast from Canada to Lee to whom else was in that. I mean, I think John Hodiak and also, let's see, who else was in it? But a host of people, good actors, Walter Slezak. I mean, they all came down with pneumonia. They were about to die. And, of course, the way Toulouse smoked cigarettes. But I will never forget the opening shots of that movie. There she is, not a hair out of place, with a typewriter. And she is Connie Porter, the worldwide correspondent. And I thought, my God in heaven, you have just been torpedoed by a U-boat. You certainly look well-groomed and well-coiffed. But nonetheless, when she had Windows, I mean, Toulouse was outrageous. She would walk around naked and stuff like that, even when she shouldn't have been doing it, because as a young woman, she was a lovely girl. And they had a whole group of English lesbians who were called the Gallery Girls, who were friends of, or supporters of Tallulah. And one of her famous lines was, well, Tallulah was sitting out by the pool and at Windows when she got the pool put into Windows. That's the reason she did Lifeboat. She wanted that pool in because it would attract more friends. And she broke wind. And somebody said, what's that odor? She said, darling, I just farted, but I don't always spell that way.
Oh, I'm sitting, and by the way, I share a birthday with her. She was 100, she would have been 100 years old January 31st of last year.
And God, did she play some wonderful roles. I mean,
I love some of these quotes. It's the good girls who keep diaries, the bad girls never have the time.
There you go. There you go.
So if I had my life to live again, I mean, some of this stuff sounds almost Groucho Marx-esque. If I had my life to live again, I'd make the same mistakes only sooner.
That's it.
Pure as the driven slush.
That's it.
Yeah, so she may have been a little too bawdy for Scarlett. But interestingly, I'm just doing some reading while we're talking, and Vivian Leigh announced at the moment she got done reading Gone with the Wind, long before production had started, she said, I will be Scarlett O'Hara. You watch and see.
She was a very determined lady, particularly before the mental problems overtook her. And like I said, she did so many other roles than GWTW, but I mean, I hate to say it, but compared to what we've got now on the screen, and I'm going to quote Gloria Swanson from Sunset Boulevard. You know, in those days, they had faces. And in those days, they did. Can you find any actress today who could really compare with some of those ladies who just absolutely swept you out of your seat when you saw them? I can't.
No, and some of that had to do with the demise of the, you know, of the studio contract system and the public relations mill that was Hollywood. I mean, I don't know. Who am I thinking of? Meryl Streep.
Yeah.
Has that kind of range and scope as an actor.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
By the way, Darlene just dropped a note in regarding Ms. Bankhead. She said, you know, she was tiny. She only clocked in at 5'3". Well, you know, dynamite comes in small packages.
Absolutely. She had a sister named Eugenia who was equally beautiful. They were two beautiful girls, and they were sort of like at loggerheads with one another over who could do what. But Tallulah definitely is one to be remembered and one whom I also revere. And, of course, we can go on and go on and go on, but Lord have mercy. They did have faces then, and they were convincing. I mean, Joan Crawford, God have mercy, to have come for what she did when she played, you know, she was almost on her way out when Mildred Pierce came in 1944. And that's what brought her back. But I will never forget seeing her on one of the late night talk shows. She just basically admitted her own biography, and she said, Hollywood has given me everything. It gave me my education, it gave me my ability to communicate with people, and it gave me my entire life. And she could be a pretty mean quitter. I mean, you know, Mommy Dearest, or do her any great...
I remember when Saturday Night Live did the send-up of Mommy Dearest. Do you remember that, Jim?
I do.
And Gilda Radner played played Joan Crawford's child. And I was, well, sweet thing, I was going to bring you a doll, but your mother said you'd rather have a nice hunk of raw liver.
That's about the way Joan was. I don't know why she was like that. But, you know, she, I think, wasn't. She was married, I don't know how many times. Groucho Marx was one of her husbands, and she had this lawyer in Hollywood named Greg, somebody, I can't remember his last name, who first got her those adopted children, because no agency would adopt her because we're, you know, profession and lifestyle and stuff like that. But
oh, by the way, you started a bit of a competition. Marty just said, I would argue that Naomi Watts is that good, and Sandra just said Isabella Rossellini. And I think both. I tend to lean more toward Isabella Rossellini.
Well,
but Naomi Watts is not terrible.
Not me. I mean, you know, I saw Isabella Rossellini, and I think it was Blue Velvet with Dennis Hopper and Kyle MacLachlan.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, but as far
that's a tough movie.
It is a tough movie, particularly with Dennis Hopper sniffing all this stuff and. Oh God, I never could quite understand.
But you know, if you sign up for a Lynch movie, you know you're not in for your usual shoot. It's like if you sign on for a James Cameron movie, you know sooner or later you're going to be in the water.
Absolutely. And there's one more I want to add, the one whom I love so dearly, and that was Audrey Hepburn.
That's interesting. You would note that I just watched Roman Holiday a couple of days ago.
Oh, my Lord. I mean, that girl, when she was young, was a runner for the resistance and would actually risk her life to take messages to the underground at the city that was occupied by the Nazis in the Netherlands.
Yeah, I was going to say, she was Dutch, right?
Right, she was Dutch. It's a matter of fact, she was so starved when she was young that she didn't grow that fast, and she attributed many of the illnesses that would portray her, that would, actually not portray, but...
Beset her?
Beset her, yes, thank you. Due to the fact that she grew up so malnourished during the Nazi resistance. But, I mean, to have come for what she did and to have played the role she did, I will never forget. I mean, she was a lady who you could take a bed sheet and drape it around her, and no couturier could even...
And, of course, Roman Holiday is her first film, and then she follows that shortly after with Sabrina. You know, some of the most unlikely casting you would ever imagine, with her in the title role, and then William Holden and Humphrey Bogart in the lead male roles. I mean, wow. Yeah, who came up with that?
God only knows.
But, you know, that one shot, and Agnes and I watched the movie together because, you know, that's a great, you know, Roman Holiday is a wonderful romance, and we had the great. There's a debate, you know. There after they, you know, they've escaped from the secret agents and or secret service, whatever, and they're back in his apartment, and you see the scene of her coming out of the bathroom with his robe on, and I looked at Agnes and said, "Well, did they?"
Well,
and she said, "No, they did not." And,
yeah.
And so, I mean, because William Wyler does not make anything explicit. It is left up to you. But that final scene, Jim, that final scene after, you know, where the audience is being had, and she turns and she walks, you know, off stage, and the empty chair is there, and Gregory Peck is the last to leave, and he takes a beat looking at the chair, turns obliquely, another beat, and then begins walking down that long, ornate Baroque or Rococo Italian hall, and it's that, and Wyler deliberately gives you that long, long shot, and then in that final moment when he turns one last time to see if she's going to come back, my God, if you at that moment, that would make a stone weep.
Well, you know, speaking of Stones, when Audrey Hepburn came down that flight of stairs in that flowing outfit, she resembled very much the winged victory of Samothrace, that Greek statue. Remember that?
Yeah, yeah. I wonder if that was deliberate.
I don't know. Probably. I'm sure it was well planned. It would have to. And as a thing before I leave, I will never forget a breakfast at Tiffany's.
Oh, no, of course not. Of course, that was rather a bit of butchery of the actual story, but...
But still...
I mean, they had to make it all heterosexual and everything, because in the novella, it ain't.
I understand that. I've read the novella, and I understand that. But nonetheless, you know, if Holly Golightly and all the stuff they had in there, particularly that party when she was dressed in that sheath and had that long cigarette holder, and there was some woman's hair that caught on fire and stuff like that. I saw that when I was like 13 or 12 or something like that, and I was just totally in love with her. And the stuff she did for UNICEF.
Yeah.
And because she knew, I think, the trials and tribulations of growing up as a disadvantaged person. And she was a very private person when she went to Switzerland and lived with her friend George Mulders before she left us. But I just want to say to all these people we've talked about tonight, I love you, I remember you, and I know there are so many more stars in heaven tonight than there were before they came into this world.
And the nominees continue to roll in, Ron and Raleigh, for modern acting quality star power. Glenn Close, and you can sure make that argument based on, like, well, among other things, Dangerous Liaisons and Fatal Instinct. Ugh, that movie.
Absolutely. But like I say, they came from a different era, a different thing in the studio system.
And back in that era, Marty says, now that I consider from that era, I'd have to rate Ingrid Bergman very much above all. And there's, yeah.
She did very well. She certainly did. She did play some marvelous things.
Well, you know what? I can tell you this much. If you're 15 years old and it's maybe 1978 and the late movie is on and it happens to be the first time you have ever seen Casablanca, Ingrid Bergman makes a really, really, really profound impression.
Yes, she does. Instead of the others, Claude Rains as the inspector, and of course, Bogey. And we can't.
I saved my first drink to have with you. Yeah.
Exactly. And we can't mention Bogey without mentioning Slim, Lauren Bacall.
No. Even. God, that. The film version of To Have and Have Not.
Absolutely.
And, you know, William Faulkner wrote that screenplay based on a book by Ernest Hemingway.
That's
and
right.
I guess Ernest didn't, Mr. Hemingway just didn't care so much as long as the check cleared. But the relationship between that book and that film is tenuous at best.
You know, I saw an interesting television interview between his granddaughter. And apparently a number of her relatives committed suicide, including Ernest Hemingway. And they were talking to Muriel Hemingway about, you know, how she has dealt with things like that. And she gave quite a discourse about how she had been able to overcome that and live and not want to.
Well, I follow John Hemingway on Facebook and see his posts from time to time. And he is Hemingway's grandson. He is the son of Gregory. And Gregory was the one who had all the... an absolutely tormented life. John has written prolifically and very humanely about his family, and it's something to behold.
Absolutely. I mean, people who have demons like that, that's certainly a tragic thing, but nonetheless, I better get off here because you've got other callers waiting.
I know, and we've... This has turned into Jim and Bob at the movies, which ain't necessarily a bad thing. I appreciate it, Jim.
Well, I enjoyed this conversation a great deal.
You have a good evening, Jim.
And likewise, sir, you too.
Bye.
Good night.
Our buddy Jim, and yeah, I'm easily diverted. I'm a movie freak. Ron and Raleigh noting, as far as pure beauty is concerned, two words, Grace Kelly. Oh, please. I think of To Catch a Thief. Wow. So, yeah, all of those things. Let's go ahead and keep the lines going, and then we'll get back to some Titanic Tuesday stuff later. Still working our way toward $150 this evening. We're $10 along the way, thanks to Rob stepping up and helping out after Margaret's act of kindness earlier today. So, thanks a lot. PayPal button, you know where it is. $5, $10. It all helps keep things going here. Hey, welcome to the program.
Sure now.
Hey, Bill.
You guys really were going. My mom's brother drove a truck for the Film Transit Company around Ohio when they used to move the movies, you know?
Yeah.
And he was a movie buff of the highest degree when it came to the founding businessmen of the early movies. The you know, Mayer and Warner and all, but he was really deep. There's a book, it's either called An Empire of Their Own or An Empire of Our Own, which traced the movie business strong. And, I have a thing. I was never a big fan of stuff when I was a kid. And when I saw it in later years, I began to maybe to understand it better or to appreciate it better. But, what's her name in Lifeboat? It's the senator's daughter.
Tallulah Bankhead. Yeah, that's what we were talking about.
Yeah, she was in that, I remember. And the guys that were my thing, the Bogarts and the very masculine type, Key Largo, and the things that Bogart did, Big Sleep, and that's where I got the pleasure. But as I got older, then I understood a lot more. And my sister was a musical person, but it was the movies were such a big thing when I was still, because you know television would not allow any of their big stuff to be played in the early 50s.
Right.
They tried to keep that stuff off the, because they thought the television would fold if they didn't give them anything. But I went a lot to the second run neighborhood stuff to catch up with things that I hadn't seen the first time around. And what was the book? I think it was the first movie that Jane Fonda was in, Walk on the Wild Side. It was so different from the book. Is amazingly different when you read the book. It was like, what? Because if they had run that, if they had taken that book directly, they probably never would have got it on the screen. It was pretty heavy. Did you ever read that?
Uh-uh.
I'm trying to think who wrote it. If somebody can Google it quick. Because it was a well-known writer. And it was set in New Orleans. And the one character in the book looked at that thing. I was 14 or 15 and say, what the hell? You know, what's this? Because you're trying to fight your way through to get to the things you didn't know. But I would recommend that Empire of Their Own to anybody who really wants to get a look at the movie business. Because the business, and while you're familiar with the wars between the stars and the studios, aren't you?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that was, they wanted to, you know, what it is, with our friends, the capitalists of any stripe, they want to keep control over everybody. As we saw that happen with Kurt Flood in the baseball business.
Yeah, in fact, I was about to draw that same parallel.
Yeah, that's the way it was, you know. I mean, they not only own your contract, they could sell it and you to somebody else. That was kind of ridiculous. But yeah, you guys had me going there because some of that stuff, I didn't discover the value of it until I was, you know, in my late teens, and then I kind of could sit and watch. To this day, the Classic Movie Channel is always a a good attempt, because you don't, because a lot of it isn't visual effects. It's the drama part of the story.
Right. Now everything, a movie doesn't have a chance unless it's got a lot of, you know, things go boom.
Yeah.
I mean, Matthew McConaughey made a film in the last couple of years called Mud that is just brilliant. And you know, it was surprising for the relatively little bit of boom that was in it.
Yeah.
On the other hand, something like Pirates of the Caribbean 3 was nothing but one long string of special effects and crap blowing up.
It reminds me, except with the fact that it has much better effects than a lot of the Errol Flynn stuff. You know, Captain Blood, I think, was one of his, and a lot of swashbucklers and sword fighting, you know. But now they can do such spectacularly wonderful things. Hell, there was a movie that I saw on television called Hearts in Bondage. It was a Civil War thing that ended up in the battle between the Monitor and Merrimack. Was a big part of the thing. And I think I've only seen it once on television. I think that's where my fascination with the Philippine campaign in 1942 was from watching Robert Taylor in Bataan, and then there was another one called Corregidor where they, and you're a young kid, you know, 6-7 years old, and this stuff catches your attention. I just reread a pretty good book that was without 10-15 years ago, Ghost Soldiers, when they the U.S. Rangers led a raid on Cabanatuan prison to free 1,000 people. And with the great help of a couple hundred Filipino guerrillas who held a bridge and kept the Japanese reinforcements from reaching that camp, they put these guys, these wounded men and these prisoners who were a mess, they put them into carabao-driven carts and moved them and got them back to the American lines. And that was such a remarkable thing, to go out and rescue about 1,000 men who were about half dead, you know. I still have a problem with Japan, because I don't, maybe because I'm German, and like my one German buddy said, the thing about the Germans is, as usual, their accurate record keeping really caught them and made them look like what they were. Whereas, you know, the Japanese medical detachment up there in Manchuria and the stuff they were pulling with the operations and such, it wasn't as big as what Mengele was doing, but it was right along the same lines. And I guess what we did with the Japanese is we got all their information and never prosecuted the guy who was running it, which doesn't sit well with me, because he's still guilty. That was the other big race between the Russians and the Americans for the German rocketeers or whatever. Who was it, von Braun?
Yes.
Wasn't he behind the Jupiter rocket, the first one that was successful?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if we got anything off the ground in those early days, it was because of Wernher von Braun.
Yeah. Well, they were working a lot in Alabama, weren't they?
Yeah, Huntsville. Yeah, that's where he settled. The Marshall Space Flight Center and the Redstone Arsenal.
Yeah. God almighty.
If the rocket goes up, who cares where it comes down? It's not my concern, says Wernher von Braun.
Well, I think it's a great piece of work. I think he was in on the V-2s or whatever they were shooting up in Holland for so long. You talk about it, and, you know, Hitler was building that stuff when he needed everything else, but no matter what he built, because of what he had to face on the Eastern Front. And I don't think sometimes there's Americans who want to give the Russians credit.
The credit they're due? Yeah.
Yeah, for what they did. And the Russian soldier, when you had the Nazis in front of you and the KVD in back of you, man, what a bad place to be.
Yeah, that's not a happy situation.
No. Because they were, and Stalin was pulling strings all over the Soviet Union, sending people to the East, and this guy and that guy. Because I don't think we have ever been given an accurate picture of the numbers of minority groups in the old Soviet Union and how bad things were for them. Hell, that was one Russian general was captured outside Moscow, and he put together a large group of Tartars and a few others, different, you know, bunches of people from the old Soviet Union who thought they'd be better off fighting Stalin. And that was a scandal when they sent those guys back to Russia at the end of the war. But what the hell are you going to do? This is your ally and blah, blah, blah. Sometimes, Bob, in this world, no matter which way you turn, your nose is running into a wall, you know, no matter where you go. Anyway, I'll let you go.
Well, Bill, I'll tell you what, I appreciate it. You have yourself a good evening.
You guys were fascinating because movies, I was never a crazy movie buff, but my uncle and his daughter and my sister were just crazy about
it. Well, one of the funny things about my father is that he could have been, had his economic circumstances and his life been just, you know, a hair different, he was such a polymath. He would always tell me that, he would always emphasize to me how stupid he was and how dumb he was and how he didn't know anything, and my mother was the smart one.
Well, sometimes you feel that way. Bob, I should have got much more formal education than I did, but...
Well, and that was my point. And yet I would sit there, and I think back ever so fondly. You know, his birthday was on the 1st, and
yeah,
he's been much on my mind. But I think back ever so fondly to the education I got watching football games with him, watching basketball games with him.
He could communicate very well, couldn't he?
Oh, well, and that's the thing. He knew a lot more than he let on.
Yeah.
We'd sit and watch old movies together, and he'd say, he'd talk about the blocking of the actors, and he'd talk about the lighting, and he'd talk about the costumes, and
he knew the tech stuff real well, didn't he?
Well, and he knew the acting. I'll never forget him looking at me and saying, you know, you can always tell a good actor from a bad actor because a bad actor, you can always tell he's acting.
That's true. That's true. These are people who couldn't, usually that's the type of person that we used to say, the person who couldn't lie their way out of a paper bag. Well, that's an actor who, no matter how many years, he can't really convince you that he is what he is portraying. And that's a hard thing to do.
Yeah.
I remember going to, even in the 60s, still going to the neighborhood movie on bank nights, so you could win a cheap set of dishes, you know? It's like, okay.
That acting versus, I mean, there are people out there who are simply expected to be who their image is whenever they appear on screen.
Yeah.
Stallone, Schwarzenegger, you know, they become caricatures of themselves. I think, and I don't think it's apocryphal. I think it actually happened. The screen test for Tony Curtis, in which it was some sort of medieval thing, and he said,
yeah,
"Yonder lies the castle of my father."
Yeah, he had the Bronx accent. Yeah.
And yeah, what are you going to do about that? But that's okay. That's okay. But then there are the people who can convey the idea that they are entirely someone else. And on those occasions when they reach that point, it is nothing short of amazing. You know, Bill Murray in Lost in Translation. You know, everybody knows who Bill Murray is. You know,
yep.
Saturday Night Live, ha ha ha, funny guy. And by the time you're done with Lost in Translation, well, it's the same effect that you get at the end of Roman Holiday. In many ways, they're very similar. You could say they're kind of the same movie, only one set in Tokyo and one set in Rome.
Yeah, see, me and acting, Mickey Rooney had already locked up the short guy position, you know, so what the hell are you going to do? Anyway.
You weren't going to go work his side of the street, huh?
No, he already held it down. I don't know, has he died yet?
I don't know.
I don't either.
Well, we'll have to find out real quick.
Well, one of these folks that are part of the Horn, these folks can dig up.
Nope. Mickey Rooney, born Joseph Yule Jr., September 23rd, 1920. No date of death given. Still here.
I'll be blessed.
So, 93 years old.
God, yeah. He did a made-for-TV drama one time where he was a gambler, and he owed everybody in the show money, and it was quite fascinating. There's some TV stuff that I've seen. The guy that played Columbo.
Oh, yeah, Peter Falk.
Place of Tomatoes that he did on television. A little, maybe it was an hour show where he was driving a truck loaded with tomatoes, and he gets involved with a pregnant woman, and he starts looking after her. Or the thing called The Sea is Boiling Hot, where a Japanese private or a Japanese whatever and an American, they ended up on an island together. And once they got past the urge to murder one another, they hung in there and survived through the thing, you know. Yeah, there was some of them. Playhouse 90 and Studio One and such were pretty good TV dramas at the time. And the thing about TV drama was, in those days, the special effects were not meaningful at all to speak of. I keep coming back to, you know, the TV's on a corpse in a detective story, and the guy doesn't switch the camera, and you see the corpse get up and walk off the floor. Whoops! That was live TV. And live commercials. One of the Macy's parades, they had kids, you know, younger people selling the new toys, you know, get demonstrating and showing you this and that. And at one point, the kids get confused, and one says, are we supposed to be standing here or over there? And it's like, okay, so far so good. But I still think the funniest was the parabolic microphones they used to use on the sidelines at pro football games. And the Thanksgiving game between Detroit and Green Bay, you hear a voice saying, where are you going to spot the bleeper, you mother bleeper? I'm standing there in the living room saying, let one out all over the United States. That, you know. And I think they cut back on the volume on those parabolics.
I think they just raised them when they felt like it was safe and kept it potted down when it wasn't.
Because that was the funniest thing about television. The live stuff could lead to some god-awful quick laughs. What do you say? Nothing like seeing a corpse get up. Well, I'll tell you another movie real quick that I loved. It was Lavender Hill Mob. You ever see that?
Uh-uh.
Peter Sellers. These guys steal all this gold, and they make statues out of it, and the statues get loose, and they have to go retrieve the statues, and at one point there's a police chase that is outlandish. The police car collides with a getaway car, and the antennas wrap around each other. And over every police car in the next few scenes, it comes the song that was playing on the radio, which was Old MacDonald Had a Farm. So here's these cops sitting in their zone cars and blaring out of their police radios was some English guy singing Old MacDonald Had a Farm. English movies were, well, there was a whole troop of guys. The Carry On series was a bunch of slapstick you used to see in art houses. And it was funny, but of course that's me. Slapstick is still funny to me, whether it's a pie in the face or something that, unless you're the one getting it. And I got one time on a job, and at first my first reaction was to reach out for the person that did it and choke him. And then all of a sudden I threw my head back and I just started to laugh as hard as everybody else because it hit me how funny it must look. Anyway, stay out of trouble.
Gonna try. Bill, you have yourself a good evening. Our buddy Bill, Mr. Stress, calling from Cleveland. And, okay, back to Titanic Tuesday. Because we've got too rich a bumper crop. By the way, with an estimated this is Titanic. With 5% of the vote in Virginia, where Ron Paul encourages people to engage in nullification and secession, are there no remnants left of the burnt to a cinder Richmond to remind people how stupid that was? Guess not, because with 5% of the estimated 5% of the vote in, Ken Cuccinelli. Yeah, they got a spray for that now. Ken Cuccinelli leads Terry McAuliffe 52% to 39%, with Libertarian Robert Sarvis rolling in at around 9% of the vote. We'll keep an eye on that. And let's stay in the South while we're at it. Because one of the other elections taking place tonight is a special election being held to fill the seat of outgoing House of Representatives member Joe Bonner, a Republican. And there's a runoff election tonight in Alabamistan. It features a challenge between Bradley Byrne, B-Y-R-N-E, no kin to David, and Dean Young. Now, he's kind of got, that's one of those kind of Hollywood 50s sitcom kind of names, but no. Dean Young wouldn't get nowhere near Hollywood. He'd probably call it Hollyweird. Bless their hearts, the Guardian newspaper interviewed Dean Young last week, according to an article in Mother Jones. See, that's called attribution. Rand Paul, that thing on your head. The Guardian asked Dean Young to identify the current House Majority Whip, to which Dean Young responded, "Well, that'd be Eric Cantor." Right? Yeah. Of course, it isn't Eric Cantor. But that didn't slow down Dean Young in the least. They asked him, "Well, Dean Young, who is Treasury Secretary?" And he said, "Henry Paulson." "No, it ain't Tim Geithner." "Yeah, Tim." No. "Oh no." Dean Young refers to the country of birth for President Barack Obama as, "That's the $64,000 question." Actually, it's not even the 64-cent question, Dean Young. The word is Hawaii. Or as you might say it, Hawaii. Yeah. He's a fundy, an evangelical fundy, Dean Young is. The district in which they're running, Mother Jones notes, is so red as to make the winner of the runoff the almost certain winner of the congressional seat. And Dean Young himself used to be, I guess, the PR flack for Judge Roy Moore. You'll remember Judge Roy Moore as being the creep who took a big leak on the First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States by putting a great big rock with the 10 freaking commandments on it, such as he understood them to be, in front of his courthouse, or in front of the Capitol of the state of Alabama. He hung them on the wall in his courtroom, Judge Roy Moore did. Judge Roy Moore wound up getting removed from office as a result. And the centerpiece of his family values Christianity has been to have at the Homer sectionals. He says Homer sectionality is deviant and destructive. He came in at one time for Secretary of State and said that, and this is the kicker, this is just a beauty. This is back in, 2002? And he said it was time for all the homosexuals to go back to wherever they came from, Vermont or California, because homosexuality it ain't an Alabama family value. And he said
if they don't like the laws of Alabama, then maybe they need to go back to California or Vermont or wherever they came from.
And referred to people in Alabama who are agitating, I think that may be a appropriate word, or at least advocating for full civil rights for people who have relationships differently than Dean Young thinks they should. He referred to them as nothing more than a gnat on the rear end of an elephant. Really? Not kidding. He expresses all. He does not flinch. He does not blink. He does not shy away from expressing opinions about homosexuals. He said, and he's talking about homosexuality. He said, if animals tried it, they would get bit. I mean, we love all homosexuals, but we don't appreciate their lifestyle. To the homosexuals who will not change, you are not welcome here in Etowah County or in the state of Alabama. And this is another one of those Randy Paul Goatwig boy moments. Because even though he said it repeatedly in speech after speech after speech, when a journalist confronted him about, well, I never said that. No, sir. Not in the least. It's so much of the typical right-wing fundamentalist evangelical crap that you are familiar with if you are a long-time listener or even a short-time listener to this program. We are witnessing, this was last month, he said, we are witnessing the end of a Western Christian empire. We will see the end of this nation if we don't do something and do it fast. Empire. Christian empire. How about that? 200 and some odd years of constitutional government and, well, granted, I've been sitting here saying that the United States is an empire, but I'm coming from the perspective of that not being a good thing. Dean Young, on the other hand, thinks it is. It's a wonderful thing to be a Western Christian empire, but it's coming to an end if we don't do something fast. And then somebody who apparently was just looking for humor material asked about stem cell research. And he said, stem cell research? Tell me the fat has the same thing, and there's plenty of fat here. We don't mess with babies. Hoo-wee! He's been on the Alabama Board of Education, where he supported teaching creationism in Alabama STEM schools. Tale secret. We know already that I grew up in Alabama STEM, first 18 years of my life, with many, many, many multi-week trips up here. But I did my schooling and my growing up in Alabamistan. It will probably come as a complete surprise to Dean Young, but I grew up and went to school with a whole lot of gay people. And as our Peter Godbold one noted, instead of saying hey about a young person when you're growing up in the South, they say things like, well, you know, so sensitive. You can't keep her home. She's such a tomboy. And then there were, of course, the various and sundry cruelties, which were also engaged in. But there are gay people all over Alabama. who have absolutely nothing to do with Vermont or California. And the really, really, really sobering part of all of this is that he's got a fighting chance of winning this runoff election this evening. Proving once again that this whole idea that, oh, by God, come 2014, we're going to throw those Republican bastards out on their keisters, and we're going to have good government again. Ha! Wish in one hand and in the other and see which one fills up first. The Tea Party, the Tea Baggers, are in no danger whatsoever, because the places where they're successful are places where they will always be successful. And by the way, don't get your hopes up. If in fact Bradley Byrne should win in Alabama, Stan, the only difference he has with Dean Young is the fact that he doesn't want to run all the homosexuals out of Alabama. He just wants them to stay right there in their good old Southern Gothic closets. Lord God, Billy Bob. And by the way, Fritz pointed this story out to me. Great moments on this Titanic Tuesday. Great moments in freedom protection. Second Amendment remedies. May have even mentioned this the other night. But I've been doing, you know, I'm constantly reading other stuff. I have to read things that aren't politics or my head just explodes. So I've been wandering, and you know me, my inclination is to wander around in the fields of history. And it is absolutely mind-boggling to consider that there is a connection between May the 29th, 1453, and November the 2nd, 2013. On November the 2nd, 2013, the Russellville Police Department responded to a call in which a man was accidentally shot by his child. It happened over to the Walmart about 11:04 a.m. Saturday in Russellville, or maybe by the time you get to Arkansas, maybe it's Russellville. Who got peppered real good and had injuries to his back. His little youngin' had accidentally peppered him, as they say in Franklin County, Tennessee. Got peppered real good. Because when the little fellow went to climb into Daddy's pick-em-up truck, he grabbed hold of Daddy's shooting gun, which was not a handle for jumping up into the pick-em-up truck, in the attempt to climb in, and in so doing pulled the trigger and gave Daddy a good blast in the back. Shoot him in the back, Gomez! Russellville Police Department spokesman says no one else was injured, including the child. The father was identified as Monty Wheeler and was transported to St. Mary's Regional Medical Center by Pope County EMS. His condition was stable at the time of the release. But, you know, you gotta have your freedom protecting Second Amendment remedy in your pickup truck with you when you go to Walmart, because you never know what kind of mayhem's gonna break out there. Really, because I got a story about that too. But I said May 29th, 1453. May 29th, 1453, a Tuesday, was the day that Constantinople fell. Finally, to the Ottoman Turks. Various and sundry peoples had been beating at the walls of Constantinople for 1,000 years. But those walls were formidable and had never been breached. In the winter and spring of 1453, Constantinople was ruled by a young man by the name of Constantine Palaiologos. And where once upon a time Constantinople had glittered with jewels and been encrusted with all manner of rare gems and very nearly literally clad in gold and silver, that glittering city on the Bosporus had become a shadow of its former self. They were broke, and the armies of Ottoman Sultan Mehmet II were at the door. Enter a young man from Hungary named Urban. U-R-B-A-N. He was one of a rare handful of people who were absolute experts at the fairly newfangled gunpowder weapons. And he wanted, having come down from Hungary, he wanted to use his talents for good. But at the time, Constantinople and the Rome that it was so financially destitute that all they could do was provide a stipend whereby young Urban could live in Constantinople. But they did not have enough money to provide him with the means of plying his trade. And eventually the stipend that would keep him clothed and fed and housed in Constantinople ran out too. So across the Bosporus from Constantinople, the armies of the Sultan Mehmet II, he was 21 years old, were gathering for the final assault on Constantinople. And because the West could not come up with enough money to pay him, Urban left Constantinople, crossed over, and sold his services to Sultan Mehmet II, who commissioned him to create what was called a bombard. And it was a giant thing, humongous. And basically it was a sort of straight tube brass cannon. And it would hurl a giant granite ball by force of the combustion of gunpowder, brought back, so it is said, by Marco Polo. And build it he did. And it was that device, that bombard, which finally breached the ancient walls of Constantinople and introduced Europe to the concept of firearm-based warfare. And in that moment where the bombard is successful, lay the seeds of all the death and all the misery and all the agony that is foisted upon us by the awful gun owners, the awful, lawful gun owners. One minute they're lawful, The next minute they're awful. And nothing epitomizes that better than Urban's decision to leave Constantinople, where he would likely starve and be killed in a siege, and to simply cross over and be handsomely paid and well fed by the Ottoman Turk, who saw it as his destiny to rule from Constantinople. You know, upon achieving the conquest of Constantinople, Mehmet II styled himself Kaisar I Rum, in his language, Caesar of Rome. And that city remained Constantinople until 1930, when the Turkish government changed it after the fall of the Ottoman Empire and the rise of Kemal Ataturk. The fall of Constantinople was a horrible thing. The slaughter was unthinkable. But before anybody says, well, you know, those heathens. No. No. Those were lessons learned. Who taught those lessons? Look, the Christians taught those lessons. Because when they broke the siege of Jerusalem and went pouring into that city, the crusading Christians killed every Muslim and Jew in the city. Suffice to say, indiscriminately. So just, you know, every time we get one of these awful, lawful gun owner stories, whether it be a woman in Florida who accidentally shoots her friend in the leg when she drops her purse, or the woman in California who accidentally shoots her hubby when she dropped hers at Wally World, or the young tyke who peppered daddy real good because daddy had to have his shotgun just to go to Walmart because he's that insecure, well, there you go. But I said there was another Walmart story. Yeah, there is. If you have to go there, be careful on the way out. Oh, by the way, it's just getting worse. Estimated 18% of the vote in. Ken Cuccinelli, 53%. Terry McAuliffe, 40%. And, you know, this may be a reflection of the fact that Terry McAuliffe himself, DLC-er that he is no prize. Ken Cuccinelli, who is very much concerned with how women go about dealing with their own insides. In old Virginia. But no, be careful when you go to Walmart. Because you just never really know what's going to happen. And it's not necessarily gunplay, although that has been known to happen. This is a particularly harrowing story. Four on your side broke it out that way. And it has so much of an oh my God factor that you will be hard pressed to believe the truth of it. It is the story of a simple trip to Wally World, made by far less so as time went on. If you've ever been, and I despise to even go into the parking lot. You know, there's a Hamburger Row right next to our Wally World. Arby's, McDonald's, Boob Evans, and the little girl with the pigtails and the right-wing daddy. So that would be the cowboy, the clown, the boob, and the right-wing guy with the kid with the red pigtails. And I hate even going into that parking lot to go there. Because it's madness. I mean, everybody is in a hurry to get either in or out of that nightmarish place. And I'll mention again that anytime you walk into, and I don't care where you are, anytime you walk into Wally World, nobody is smiling. Positively Soviet. So, this is from Hidalgo County, New Mexico. And the city of Deming, New Mexico. It's the story of a man named David Eckert, who had done all the shopping he cared to do at the Deming Wally World, who got into his car and engaged in that automotive rodeo that is the attempt to get out of any given Walmart parking lot, and apparently made a rolling stop and then a turn trying to get out of the parking lot. At which point, some members of Deming's Finest, actually the Hidalgo County Sheriff's Office Finest, as well as police officers with the city of Deming. It starts with the Deming Police Department. David Eckert made a rolling stop and went on, at which point the bubblegum machine started turning on the top of the roller for the Deming, New Mexico Police Department. Woo, 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 woo. So, according to KOB, news outlet, TV station, the police officer walks up to the window and says, "Sir, step out of the vehicle, sir." And then, in a feat of deductive reasoning that simply evades me, decides that when David Eckert gets out of the vehicle, he is clenching his buttocks too much. Work with me. I don't even have the first foggy idea what that means. But he is, but the cop thinks that he is clenching his buttocks too much. This was January 2nd of this year. And because Officer Sherlock Holmes Knott decides that there is too much buttock clenching going on, Columbo then decides that that is probable cause for him to believe that David Eckert has just walked out of Wally World with illegal narcotics secreted in his rectum. Rectum? Damn near killed him. Sorry. But no, really. Sir, you're clenching your buttocks entirely too hard. You're going to have to come with me, sir. I think you have dangerous Wally World narcotics in your rectum. So, as he was being detained, they radioed back to HQ to get a search warrant for David Eckert's anus. Screaming yet? You will be. And yes, a sitting judge clothed in the majesty and the mantle of justice said, what's this? A man gets out of his car at Wally World after making a rolling stop, and he's clenching his buttocks too much, and you think that he might possibly have narcotics secreted in his bowel? Where's that search warrant? Let me sign. And does. So at this point in time, David Eckert is placed under arrest and transported to the Gila Regional Medical Center, where the search warrant is originally, you know, for David Eckert's posterior, is initially presented to a physician, an MD, who said, I ain't going to do this. This is ethically awful. But then the cops leaned on him, and some other physicians there in Silver City at the Gila Regional Medical Center said, all right, we'll do it. And a little while later, they make David Eckert strip. First, for an abdominal x-ray, which comes up negative for narcotics. So then, they do a digital examination of David Eckert's anus. The doctors do. And they don't find any narcotics. Now, you can imagine how this works. And, oh, okay, there wasn't anything on the x-ray. Maybe they're just right up there. All right, get the rubber gloves and the KY jelly out. I mean, we do this every day for prostates. What the fuck, you know. Well, nothing up there. So then they go off and peas and carrots. And they confer some more. And they confer with the sheriff's deputies who say, well, maybe you didn't look hard enough up there. Oh, all right. So the doctors get a fresh set of gloves, and they grope David Eckert's posterior digitally, and I don't mean with, like, digital instruments. I mean with their fingers again. That's two more confabs. No, still not there. Well, you know, it could be passing down through the... I don't know. Do it again. Third time. They say, wait a minute, we're not getting anywhere with these manual exams. Somebody bring an enema. Really. So they subject him to an enema. At which point he then has to sit and expel same in front of the cops and the doctors. And the doctors then sort through the expelled material, I guess like ancient Roman priests trying to auger the future out of goat entrails, and no narcotics were found. More conferencing. Well, you know what, some of that stuff can be up there. Really, I mean, these drug mules, I mean, they're crafty. Give him another one! And so they violate David Eckert a second time for another enema. At which point he has to do the same thing all over again, you know, defecate in front of the docs and the cops. At which time they once again perform the auguries of his stool, and again they find no narcotics. That's the second time. So just for those of you keeping score at home, we have two digital rectal exams and two enemas. That's four brutal intrusions of David Eckert's bodily integrity. So after the second enema, there's another conference. You know, we may finally be getting somewhere. I mean, he's expelled a lot there. The third time's the charm, and yes, a third time. They administer an enema, make him sit there, expel it in front of the cops, and expel it in front of the doctors. The docs have to sort through it again. And still, no narcotics. Okay, so we're at 5 now. And at 5, nobody, I mean, they got us. Well, you know, we got a search warrant. The hell's a search warrant if you can't find what you're after? I'll bet it's up there somewhere. He probably put it up his nostrils, and it's just now you know, we didn't do a head x-ray. No, they didn't do a head x-ray. No, they said, it's probably lodged way up there. Prep him for surgery. No shit. Oh. Prep him for surgery. This was after they x-rayed his intestines again. And you would think that something as solid as maybe pills or heroin or... Right, would show up. Glass bottle. Yeah, that's going to show up. I mean, right. Prep him for surgery. And they did. And by prep him for surgery, what they meant is they were going to perform a colonoscopy on him, which has known dangers such as perforation of the colon. And also is hell on wheels because of what you have to do, because the three enemas was not enough. I mean, you got to get real cleared out for a colonoscopy to work. Yeah. We're talking about a time span here that is hours and hours and hours. All along, David Eckert is saying, what are you looking for? I don't have any narcotics. I was just coming out of Walmart. Sir, drink this. And that's the amazing thing. You know, to prep somebody for a colonoscopy, and I've had a couple, you've got to be shiny clean inside, and that means everything that's there is going to come out. And even after the prep, nothing. And he keeps telling, you know, I'm not the guy. You know, I don't have the what? But no, they still do the colonoscopy, and they run what is sometimes referred to as the steel eel up there and get a good camera look at his entire colon. And eventually, he's released. Here's the other fun part. Gila Regional Medical Center is in Grant County, New Mexico. The search warrant was issued in Luna County, New Mexico, where Deming and the Wally World in question and the traffic stop took place. So it turns out the first doc who said, no, this would be immoral and unethical and illegal, yeah, he was right. Every single nurse, every single doctor, every single cop needs to become unemployed and unemployable out of this. News Channel 4 KOB on your side, investigative reporter Chris Ramirez got hold of Deming, New Mexico Police Chief Brandon Gigante, and he said, we follow the law in every aspect, and we follow policies and protocols that we have in place. So investigative reporter Chris Ramirez says, do you think those officers in this particular case did that? And Police Chief Gigante said, talk to my lawyer. So now, David Eckert is suing the city of Deming, the Deming police officers Bobby Orozco, Robert Chavez, and Officer Hernandez. He's suing Hidalgo County, Hidalgo County deputies David Arredondo, Robert Rodriguez, and Patrick Green. He's suing Deputy District Attorney Daniel Doherty and the Gila Regional Medical Center, including but not limited to Robert Wilcox, M.D., and O.K. Odocha, M.D. You want the punchline? The Gila Medical Center sent him a bill for every last bit of it. And by him, I mean Mr. Eckert. Man, makes you just want to queue up Lee Greenwood, doesn't it? Darlene with a question. Why didn't the dude, this David guy, lawyer up after the second rectal? Not like they were offering him his one phone call, Darlene. There were people with guns standing around him while he was being violated. Ron and Raleigh, let me get this straight. So a rolling stop and the clenched buttocks are probable cause to go anal spelunking on this poor schmo. Thank God he wasn't black. We don't know that he wasn't. P.S., you know, the man could have had diarrhea, hence the clenching. The man could have just had to go. Would you, really? At Walmart? No, me either. You are correct, Jeremy. As we started this story, Jeremy noted, Bob, I sense a duct tape tennis ball moment coming right down the pike. You're there. Screaming yet? Ron and Raleigh. I'm sure, Bob, if he wasn't clenching them before, he's certainly clenching them now, yeah. Well, look, it's a cop's... If it's just a traffic stop, then, license and registration, please, and you're sitting there in your car when they say, sir, please step out of the vehicle. Clench. There's going to be clenching. Oh, Irish Dave... you are working the pro side of the street. This is clearly a case of probable cause. Shame on you. Hey, thanks, Sal. Sal has just kicked in $10. Thank you very much. That means we've only got $30 to go to finish tonight's fundraising with the start that Margaret gave us. Fourth Amendment? What Fourth Amendment? So, just to recap, while we're still having hissies, and some of them are justified, many of them are justified, about the United States spying on Angela Merkel, an American citizen can't go to Walmart and expect to come out without being violated by the police department. Yeah, Jack, you're absolutely right. Jack in Shreveport, the judge should be disciplined, too. Randy says, they remodeled my local Wally World, and I can't even find the restroom there. You don't want to. Marty says, I wouldn't go into any store that didn't have a bidet. You guys. By the way, the New York Times announcing that Governor Chris Krispy Kreme has won his re-election effort. Onward to 2016 now. 68% to 30%. With an estimated 1% of the New Jersey vote in. 8% deficit for Terry McAuliffe in Virginia. 50% to 42%. And with Alabama Stan being in the Central Time Zone, still no results. You homosexuals, you need to go back to Vermont or California, where that's where all the homosexual factories are. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program. Hello.
Yeah, I'm looking. I
hey, Kevin.
Tweet about 2 hours ago now, and that's basically what I said. Do you really believe that McAuliffe is going to win tonight? I don't have any faith in the election process anymore, because all the polls had McAuliffe ahead by what? A good 15 percentage points.
Yeah, 1 point, yeah.
Yeah, and they don't, you know, that was about a week ago. Those polls don't change that much between elections. They have early voting in VA, just like they do almost anywhere else now, and I'm sorry, I don't believe someone that's up by that many points against good, reliable polling, nonpartisan polling, can lose that many points in an election unless he does something really stupid, you know, like the one AATTP story about the guy who resigned from the church group because he had an extramarital affair. You know, unless you do something really stupid like that, you're not going to lose the election in a week. You may lose some points, but, you know.
Well, you know, Brad Friedman announced earlier in the day, Kevin, that there had been no small number of e-voting fiascos in Virginia.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I've been disgusted all day. I knew my food stamps were going to get cut, but I was surprised when I went and checked my balance on the food stamps. It had absolutely zero on there. It did have a nice little message telling me why there were no food stamps, because Congress didn't pass a bill reauthorizing the funds.
So you went from some food stamps to absolutely none?
None. Zero. And I know there was one on a story on AATTP earlier this week about a woman that was getting 200 and I want to say 250. It might have been more like 500. Yeah, it was 500 now that I think about it. $500 in food stamps. She went from that to $21. And, you know, I found that a little bit hard to believe until I checked on my food stamps today. You know, now I didn't have that much of a difference. You know, when I was getting in food stamps, I could miss like 4 meals and that would cover it, you know. But you know what I'm saying? It's just, I know there are people lots worse off than I am.
Well, way back in the Depression era, Kevin, there was a saying, and I think I've mentioned my grandmother told it to me, that when the Republicans came into office, they promised 3 meals a day. Oatmeal, skip a meal, and miss a meal. And she said, and they delivered. So this is, you know, this is that right-wing wonderland again.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, if you study history like a good many of our people do, you know that Hoover was unelected because his policies put us in that depression, and he refused to do anything about it. And it got to the point that I doubt if Hoover had somehow survived, there might not have been a coup, just for the fact that so many Americans were doing without anything. But I guess I'm having trouble putting it. How many Democrats? I guess the best way to ask it is this: how many Democrats have you heard since the story broke last week, the week before, about the food stamps weren't going to get reauthorized, that everybody was going to be having these kinds of food stamps? How many Democrats have you heard say something about that?
Not a whole hell of a lot.
I can name one, but he's not really a Democrat.
Bernie
Sanders.
Yeah.
Yep. You didn't hear Elizabeth Warren say anything about it. You didn't
well,
hear
remember,
anybody.
Remember, I mean, the Senate Agriculture Committee, which is a Democratic majority, took up the issue of food stamps and said, you know, we need to cut $5 billion out of this.
Yep.
Democrats did that in the Senate.
Yeah.
I remember the night that we discussed it in considerable detail.
Yeah. And if you go look at the list of names that are on that Agricultural Committee, or Al Franken, Democrat, Minnesota.
Debbie Stabenow.
And Debbie Stabenow. I don't know if Wasserman Schultz is.
She's in the House.
The House. Yeah. But you can't even call these people to ask them why. That's what really upsets me. You're going to get a staffer who's going to take your message, and that's the last you ever hear of them. So they have no accountability, even if you are in their state. You don't get any accountability from your senators or housemen. I don't even try with my House member because that's Doug Lamborn, so that's pointless to call Doug Lamborn. Other than if I want to yell at a staffer. So, I'm really in a bad mood and want to yell.
Well, you know what? Don't they deserve it at this point, Kevin? I mean, I'm not saying yell, but,
yeah.
You know, hi, I'm one of Congressman Lamborn's constituents. I'm disabled. I am visually handicapped. I was getting X amount of food stamps because I have a severely limited income. Now I'm getting zero, yeah. Thanks to Congressman Lamborn. What is his answer? I demand, and you get to say that. I'm his constituent. I demand an answer.
But the person takes the message, and that's the last you ever hear about it. Even if you were to call. I mean, we've done actions here in the Springs where you've gone to Lamborn's office or one of the senator's offices here. And unless it has publicity behind it, you're not going to ever hear anything back from them. And, you know, there used to be, that's why the recess in the House always happened was for you to go back to your particular district and meet with the people in your district.
Face the music.
But these teabag representatives now are controlling those meetings to where if they even suspect that you're a little bit left-leaning, you don't even get into the meeting. You know? So, freedom? Democracy? I'm really to the point where I don't believe we have it anymore.
Democracy? No, democracy has never happened in the United States. The sooner we get that all the way down to the ground, Kevin, the better off we are.
Right, yeah.
Democracy has always been aspirational, not operational in the United States.
Right. But just reading that story about the poor guy at the Walmart, that happened back in January, and we're only now hearing about it because he filed a lawsuit against them.
Right.
And you're right. Those cops should be dismissed. And, you know, even if the cop's wrong, you can kind of understand the X-ray, the stomach X-ray. But to do all that to this poor guy, I've had those colonoscopies too. One of those colonoscopies is enough. If you've got anything in you, you've taken that stuff, you know what I mean. You're cleaned out. You don't need two or three of them, you know?
Yeah, shiny. Shiny, you're cleaned out.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I remember when I had the last one. I don't really know how to take it when your colonoscopist compliments you for how empty you are. Well, okay, thank you. I really put my heart and soul into it. And I think my liver, too.
That's something that you get an award for, like you can put it up on your mantle.
Right. Yeah. You know, Laurel and Hardy handshake, certificate suitable for framing, decoder ring, what?
Right, yeah. You know, it's just, there's so many stories like that that go on, and I think it's good that we've got groups like AATTP, Right Wing Watch, Daily Cause, Talking Points Memo, but I still think countrywide we're so compartmentalized that if it doesn't happen in our neck of the woods, to use the phrase, it ain't happening.
Well, you know, but wait a minute. You said something that I kind of want to respond to, Kevin. You know why there are some? Because
what?
Because that is the nature of this country now.
Right.
And it, and it didn't get that way. This, I mean, how much? Let's assume for a moment that the guy was actually carrying what they thought he was carrying. How much could he carry?
Well, no, that what goes in must come out sooner or later.
Yeah.
You know.
But instead, they run him off to the. I don't know, and you know, this was January, so it's not like there was an Obamacare. Angle here. Well, you know, go ahead and have the hospital do it. Obamacare will cover it. That is what this...
Well, that's what I like.
That's what this country is, though, Kevin. Really and for true, that is what this country is. We are a country who are terrified, scared shitless, as it were, of itself, of everybody else, of things that go bump in the night. We are scared. That's why I refer to this as a coward nation. And that's C-O-W-E-R-E-D, not C-O-W-A-R-D, but coward. We are cowering in fear of everything.
Yep. Well, I use the A-R-D for the Democrats. I've had it completely with them as far as what they're not doing. Even with Obama's ACA, it seems like... there's a few more of them in support of it, but if you think about it, who are you hearing most about the ACA from?
The right president. Wing. Well, the right wing, really.
Well, yeah, the right. Yeah, in support of it, but yeah, the right wing. And that's the funny part about it. For as much as they complained about the ACA, now they're complaining about it not working right. You know? That's the height of hypocrisy to say that something you don't like shouldn't be there, but, oh, it's not working right now. Well, why not if you don't like it and it shouldn't be there? Why complain about it not working? Just let it keep on not working, you know? I mean, there's such... I could use the word, but they are such a-holes about everything and anything that it's just a shame. I'm utterly disgusted, like you're talking about with Alabama, with that guy down there in Alabama. Bob, I worked with some gay people in Alabama that I guarantee you, if people knew, and I'm talking these right-wing teabagger types, knew that these gay people had buried their loved ones because of a funeral home there in Birmingham, they'd be having a hissy. And it was all, I was one of maybe three straight people that worked for that company at that time. I mean, that, literally everybody else was gay with the exception of two or three of us. And I didn't think twice about it. They didn't think twice about it. The owner didn't think twice about it. Why? Because it doesn't matter. You know, you're there to do a job. Who cares what your predilection is for sex, as long as it's not unwanted? I don't care what you do in your bedroom. And I definitely should not care what you do in your bedroom if you were doing a job or trying to go out to dinner or shopping at the Wally World or whatever, but this guy wants to run you out of Alabama. You're not welcomed in whatever county that was, and you're not welcome in the state of Alabama.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you worked in Alabama, you know where Gadsden is? That's Etowah County, where the homosexuals aren't welcome.
Yeah, well, I wasn't going to try to pronounce the Etowah County. That was my, you know, I'm not going to try that, but... Yeah, it's, I don't know, and I guarantee you that I would bet there's people that are working for him or are very close to him that are gay.
Oh, please, the GOP is the biggest closet in America.
I know it. That congressman that came out yesterday saying he was gay, he had been in like 12 terms, and the reason he said he was coming out was because of all the whispers. Well, you know, I just don't understand why people care about it. I want my...
Well, because their holy book tells them that they have to oppose it because, you know, their God hates everything that they do.
Yeah, but, you know, that holy book that tells me I should oppose it tells me like, I should love one another. So, you know, the contradictedness of that, I'll fall on the love one another side of that, and also not judge another, because that same book tells me with what manner I'm judged, that's what I'll be judged by if you believe it. So, I just never have cared. I don't care what anybody's doing in their life, as long as it's not illegal or immoral, I guess you'd say, in the sense of being an illegal act upon a child or something like that. But even the supposed immoral stuff, if it's not illegal or hurting anyone, I don't care.
Well, and you see, Kevin, morality is, and the right wing just hates it when we say stuff like this, morality is far more fluid than they would like to admit.
Yeah, it is.
Because, you know, there's the essential morality. There's the essential morality that is contained in every religious code that has ever been devised by human beings on this earth. Don't do to people things you would not like to have done to them. Don't do things to people that you would hate. I mean, it's in every religious text. Most religions are not so good at following it, but it's an essential maxim for getting through life.
Yep.
But at the end of the day, you know, it's hard, you know, it's hard for them to live that. But that's an essential manifestation of morality. Other things like honor the Lord thy God and thou shalt have no other gods before me. You know, that's philosophical. That's not even philosophical. That's theological. Honor the Sabbath and keep it holy. That's theological, not even existential. So, you know, their definition of morality is going to be very different from a sane person's definition of morality.
I think that's a good way to put it. Even the, you'll have no other gods before me. How many times do we see the God of money crop up, especially on the right-wing side of things? That is their God. You know, you could name a God, so to speak, that could be anything from alcohol to drugs to whatever, depending on how you are with those things. Or it can be just something that's recreational. You know, some people can drink alcohol and they're not alcoholics. Some people can do some drugs and not become addicted. And other people have an addictive behavior and they become addictive, and you could call that their God.
Right, but the right wing wants to define us all by their determination of what the lowest common denominator is.
Right. But the world never has been and never will be. No matter how much they want it to be so, the world has never been black and white. There's always shades of gray. Like the old thing about, is it still a sin if a man steals a loaf of bread to feed his family when he doesn't have any?
Right, and the fact that there had to be a debate about that, please.
Yep.
You know, no. And most cultures have said no. Except that, you know, there's a, you know, a twisted few that say, yep, that's stealing, gotta die. Gotta cut your hand off now.
Yeah because my ex-roommate used to love to quote that. If you steal once, cut off your hand, steal twice, and you don't eat. Well, you know, that's very charming, but that doesn't do anything.
Well, it doesn't address the fundamental question of why did the person need to steal to eat. Right. Now, the right wing would answer by saying, because they're lazy, no good moochers who don't know how to work.
Yeah. Yeah, just like apparently all 5,000 people or families got cut off food stamps, military families who are active duty.
Yeah.
Some are disabled. Yeah. But we can't pay our active duty military, and they're working much harder than most people, because when you're on active duty, you know, I've worked 24 hours a day a couple of times. You're there, and that's your duty. You don't rest until the job's done. And so a lot of these people out there are getting 4, 5, 6 hours of sleep a night if they're lucky. They're dodging bullets. They're dodging accidents just from being so tired. You know.
Well, how would you feel if you were still posted in the god awful illegal war in Afghanistan, and it filtered back to you that your family's food stamps had been cut off? Well, I tell you what, that's the country I want to lay down my life for.
Yep. Well, I said that long ago, Bob. Back before I ever lost my sight. I said, if given a choice, I wouldn't serve again because of that very fact. There is nothing there for you in the military anymore like there used to be, and certainly for your families. You don't even get free medical care anymore for your families. You get on this stupid TRICARE thing, and that's just gotten worse over the years. And now they can't even give the military people, and I'm not talking defense budget like guns and rockets and bullets. I'm talking defense budget about adequate pay for our soldiers that they can maintain enough to not have to be on food stamps to begin with. But these Tea Party patriots, you don't even hear them raising a whimper over that. About military families being taken off food stamps and not having enough money. So, yeah, if you're over there in Afghanistan, what's that going to make you feel like when your wife says, don't have any money to feed the kids? You know?
Well, you know, they should have done a better job budgeting their family monies each month. We all have to live on a budget every month. The government has to live on a budget every month. I mean, how many times have we heard that drivel from the teabaggers? Yes, to the point of nausea, I know.
And then that's the other thing I was thinking about a lot today while I was at an appointment and wasn't getting picked up, is the fact that these people who say that either never have been poor or have forgotten what it was like. They have no comprehension about what the world outside of their version of it is living or has to deal with on a daily basis. And that is the, you know, years ago they used to have a Scared Straight program where they took these kids into the
prisons. Yeah.
Prisons. You remember that? Well, that, I think that's maybe what we need to do with the teabaggers. Make them come live with somebody who can't work. You know, I mean, that.
Give them the Job treatment. Take everything away from them.
Right.
Make moochers out of them.
Yep.
But see, the thing is, there's another angle here, Kevin. They are so unperceptive. They are so unself-actuated that if something like that befell a teabagger, they would immediately blame the government.
Yep.
Gummis fault.
Yep.
I saw an article out of Georgia about some guy whose meat business was going out, it's the government's fault, and you know that Obama. But then it turns out the guy, the backstory on the guy is that he's never been worth a damn at anything.
Yep.
He had a real estate business. Yeah. He crashed it. He had a construction business. He crashed it. He went into a specialty meat business for his buddies who were barbecue fanatics. He crashed it. That's not, you know, and then he said, well, the banks say they won't loan me any more money because of Obama. Well, you know what? If you're the local banker, we can't loan you anymore because they've already lost their ass on him, right?
Right, exactly.
Can't loan you anymore. Well, why? Well, you know, those Obama bank rules. Oh, yeah, I should have known, Kenyon. Right?
Well, yeah, that's their fallback. It's Obama, no matter what it is. You know, how many people believe that Obama's the fault is just become a running joke. You know, something that happened, the Depression.
Yeah, my coffee wasn't hot enough the other day. Damned Obama. Kenyon's.
Right, it's Obama's fault.
Cold Kenyon coffee, damn it. Exactly.
Yep.
Hey, Kevin, I'm going to roll. I'm going to try to get one more phone call in here.
Great. All right.
All right. We'll talk to you soon. Good talking to you this evening. All right. Bye now.
Bye.
My buddy Kevin calling from Colorado Springs. Onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Jeremy. What's happening?
Hey, Bob. Hey, the right wing still is providing that three hots and a cot. You just have to go to jail to get it.
Yeah, that's why it's three hots and a cot, isn't it?
It is three hots and a cot.
Well, I mean, if you count prison cheese as a hot.
Yeah, that's... Yeah, and their special, like, mystery meat, which is a mixture of...
Soylent Green, baby.
Pretty much.
Soylent Green is prisoners.
I don't know how that guy that went through that stuff with that sheriff and the doctors and stuff didn't start throwing his poo at them like freaking monkeys.
You got to understand that it, at that point in time, it is a crime scene, and he was, you know, held away from where they were... doing the fecal augury. So there will be no flinging. Besides, there were enemas involved. Very liquid.
I would have augured them with something myself at that point, I think, after the second one, and then not just going along with, hey, I don't have anything, this is a mistake.
Well, George W. Bush... Dim leader used to refer to people who won lawsuits after horrible, horrible things had happened to them. He'd say, hey, well, that's those people who win life's lottery. He said that about somebody who went in for an amputation of one leg and the doctor cut the wrong leg off and then had to go back and cut the other leg off. And, of course, at the same time, there was a story about a woman who went in for a mastectomy and the doctor removed the wrong breast and had to go back and the other breast. And George W. Bush said, hey, those people won life's lottery because of our out-of-control legal system that gives away these ridiculous awards. No, really, he did, Jeremy. I remember when he said, the problem with America right now is that our OBGYNs can't practice their love for America's women.
Yeah, I remember that well, and I also actually remember the whole part about people winning life's lottery because bought surgeries and stuff. The doctors screwed up.
Yeah.
And you know, probably he probably gets that mentality from his mother. After all, she thinks Katrina was good for people in the Superdome. So
I'm just afraid they're going to like it here in Houston.
She was probably saying people had it good when they were getting a $100,000 payout for their dead relative that died in Iraq. That was a good thing for them. I mean, that made their life all set. You know, I mean.
Yep, that's that 1907 Monongah mine disaster attitude. Well, this ought to make a pretty nice Christmas for some of those widows and orphans. $70.
That, when you said that the other night, that was breathtaking to know that they actually, someone had come up with that and saying that it might make a good Christmas. This will probably make a pretty good Christmas for people. I mean, it's not something I don't expect, but at the same point, it's shocking enough that it's still kind of stunned.
It is plumb factual.
And there's no words to express rage for that kind of stuff. It's just pure unadulterated capitalism at its best.
Yeah, and being outraged over something that happened in 1907, I guess, is kind of pointless. But there is a point when you realize, for instance, with this Center for Investigative Journalism report on this filthy law firm in Charleston, West Virginia, called Jackson and Kelly, that has spent a generation deliberately trying to keep poisoned coal miners from getting their black lung benefits. then, you know, then it comes forward into the present, and you go, oh, wait, nothing's changed, I'll be damned. Yay, capitalism! But at least something's being done about that. The Johns Hopkins lab, where, and our buddy Harry brought this to my attention, the Johns Hopkins lab, where a lot of this phony baloney science was cooked up that kept poisoned miners from getting their federal black lung benefits, yeah, it's been shut down by Johns Hopkins. So now if we can start seeing some lawyers permanently disbarred here in West Virginia over this, well, it'll be a good thing. Hey, Jeremy, I got to get out of here. We are fresh out of time. I'm glad we got to talk, though.
Yeah, no problem.
All right, see you. Bye now.
Yeah, bye.
And thus we find ourselves at the end of this Titanic Tuesday. Thanks going out again to everyone who helped make today a success. Thanks to Sal. Thanks to Rob. Thanks to Margaret. Thanks to Gene. Thanks to Grant. It is your help that keeps this all going, and we are indeed forever grateful. Thanks to all our all-volunteer staff. Thank you to Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox down in Australia, who helps us keep all of the machines behaving somewhat normally. Thank you to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. White Rose Society has become very much like the sign at McDonald's. Billions and billions served. I don't know how many millions of hours of progressive radio has reached people as a result of Ben Birch's labors with the White Rose Society, going all the way back to 2002. Thank you, Ben. Thank you very much. And Ben Birch has never sent a bill. And, of course, thanks go always to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACHECT.org, ACHECT.org. That's where you go if you want to be a part of the ongoing effort to bring an end to the seemingly endless nightmare that is mountaintop removal in Appalachia. It makes a great deal of difference when you take part, because this is a grassroots effort. Just go there, read the science, read the bill, make yourself conversant enough to talk about it, and then contact your member of the House of Representatives if they haven't signed on, and say why not, and explain to them how important it is. If they have signed on, thank them. And then say, can you help us get some more people to sign on, please? And then you can always reach out to your members of the United States Senate and say, I want this bill introduced in the Senate. Time's a-wasting. People are dying. Get with it. Those are all things that you can do that will make a difference. And it all starts with you going to ACHECT, A-C-H-E-A-C-T, .org. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.
Rick Smith is next on the Horn.